You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
This podcast is brought to you by Motorola.
Hey, baby, I know it's late, and I'm sorry I sent that photo of you on my phone to Barry, but I think it was a mistake that we broke up, because I still love you.
Great phones, but we can't tell you how to use them.
I like your hair and that. I like your cat. I like your pink skirt with the buckles on it. I like your glasses. I love your house.
G'day world. Cameron Riley here with the most exciting interview that I've done in the last 12 months since we started the G'day World show. If you don't know who Noam Chomsky is, hopefully by the end of this show you'll have an insight into his political activism over the last 50, 60, 70 years. And my goal with this show is that some of you will be motivated to go out, buy some of his books, get your head around what he's talking about, investigate the subjects for yourself, and hopefully get involved in some form of political activism. Let me read you a short biography on Professor Chomsky. This is from Wikipedia. Avram Noam Chomsky, PhD, born December 7th, 1928, is the Institute Professor Emeritus of Linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Chomsky is credited with the creation of the theory of generative grammar, often considered the most significant contribution to the field of theoretical linguistics in the 20th century. He also helped spark the cognitive revolution in psychology through his review of B.F. Skinner's Verbal Behavior, which challenged the behaviorist approach to the study of mind and language dominant in the 1950s. His naturalistic approach to the study of language has also impacted the philosophy of language and mind. He is also credited with the establishment of the so-called Chomsky hierarchy, a classification of formal languages in terms of their generative power. Chomsky is also widely known for his political activism and for his criticism of the foreign policy of the United States and other governments. He describes himself as a libertarian socialist, a sympathizer of anarcho-syndicalism. What does all that mean? I have no idea, but I hope that over the course of the next half hour in my chat with Professor Chomsky, you get a little bit of an insight into where he's coming from in terms of his political activism. We don't touch on the linguistics. And if I have one goal with this show is that it acts as an introduction for people who aren't familiar with his work. Perhaps they will then go out, maybe buy a book, maybe start to investigate some of these issues on their own behalf, decide for themselves what's going on in the world. And maybe some of you will then get involved in some form of political activism, get involved in the political process in your country. So, without wasting any more time, I bring you my interview with Professor Noam Chomsky.
Hello.
Hello, Professor Chomsky.
Yeah, speaking.
Cameron Riley from the Podcast Network in Australia.
Yeah.
How are you?
Yeah, sorry to keep you waiting, but everything was running behind as always.
That's okay. I appreciate you taking some time to chat with us.
Yeah. Tell me what we're doing.
Well, this is a recording for a podcast that we'll put out in the next couple of days to a global audience. And what I'm hoping to do with the time that we have with you today is just to almost do a basic primer on Noam Chomsky's view of the world, if we can.
Well, that's a simple one.
Are you up for that?
Sure, why not?
Excellent.
Not on the universe, just the world.
Just on the world.
Okay, we'll keep it simple.
I will. Okay, so Professor Chomsky, a recent poll voted you the world's leading thinker, and I've read that only Shakespeare and the Bible have been cited in scholarly publications more often than you. But, you know, over the last couple of weeks, as I've sort of been telling friends and colleagues about this upcoming interview with you, I've discovered that many of my peers either aren't familiar at all with your work, you know, if they haven't studied humanities and they're not political activists, or if they have heard of you but haven't read any of your books, they have this impression that you're some kind of left-wing conspiracy nut. So, for my peers who don't know who or what a Noam Chomsky is, and obviously leaving aside your work in linguistics, because I'm sure that's over most of our heads anyway, are you able to summarize for us your political views? I know that's probably asking a lot after 30 or 40 years of political activism, but can you summarize for us as an entry point, perhaps, your view on what's happening, particularly with, obviously, U.S. politics and U.S. foreign policy?
Well, I've not written extensively on it. The U.S. policy, let's just keep to the post-Second World War period, just set a time frame.
Mm-hmm.
At the time of the Second World War, the United States, for the first time, became a major actor in world affairs generally. Prior to the Second World War, the United States had, first of all, conquered the national territory, meant eliminating the indigenous population. It had conquered half of Mexico. It had extended its power over the Caribbean region. It had kicked the British out of Venezuela, big oil producer. It had moved on to Hawaii and the Philippines. It was engaged and was joining other European powers and undermining China, but it was not a leader in world affairs. In fact, Britain was much more so. But after the Second World War, that changed totally, and it was understood. I mean, there were planning sessions of high State Department officials and Council on Foreign Relations. It's the main so-called private input into foreign affairs. They were having study groups from 1939 through 1945 in which they recognized clearly that the U.S. would emerge from the Second World War as the world dominant power, and they made extensive plans about how it should use that power. And if you look at the years that followed, when many of the same people were in government, in corporations, in planning and decision-making positions, in various ways they implemented similar plans. And it continues pretty much until the present. Now, of course, plans always change. Circumstances change. You need different tactics. There are different pretexts and so on. But the basic themes remain pretty much the way they were articulated in the wartime studies groups, of which we have the documents. You can read them. They're not terribly surprising. They are that the basic idea is that the United States should create a system of global order extending as far as possible, which would operate for the benefit of privileged sectors of power within the United States and their counterparts elsewhere. Well, that means primarily the corporate sector, which pretty much dominates American society and is closely linked to similar sectors in other societies. And that means a world of a kind of liberal internationalism in which countries are compelled in one way or another to subordinate themselves to the economic and political and social arrangements that are supportive of U.S. power interests. That means opportunities to invest, exploitation of the populations, access to resources and markets, control of essential resources like energy. It was understood clearly in the Second World War and before that the control of the energy resources of the world is a major instrument of global power. The Middle East oil-producing regions were described in the mid-1940s as a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the great material prizes in world history, the most strategically important part of the world. And, of course, the U.S. is going to take control over that. That's what a lot of contemporary developments are about. That's a major theme that runs through the whole period. Europe and Japan had to be reconstructed in certain ways, in ways which undermined the labor movement from the left and restored the traditional societies pretty much. With regard to the Third World, it simply had to be kept under control. So if moves towards independent development took place, they had to be stopped. And if it looked as if they might be successful and influence others, they might be what planners call a virus that might infect others, then they have to be really destroyed. And so we have a brutal history of intervention and violence to try to ensure that the South will subordinate itself to the interests of the major sectors of power in the rich developed countries, and the United States is foremost among them. I mean, those are basic themes of policy. They don't explain everything that happens, but policy rarely departs very far from those major themes. Now, they can be implemented in different ways, so that the Clinton administration and the Bush administration are not identical. They're somewhat different, in fact, in the ways they proceed. But the basic dominating themes have not changed very much. I mean, to call this a conspiracy theory is utterly insane. I mean, it's like saying that governments and corporations and other institutions are engaged in conspiracies when they do planning. I mean, it's like saying that General Motors is involved in a conspiracy when it tries to sell cars. That's just the word. It's just a way of trying to prevent rational analysis. There's no conspiracy. I mean, if the U.S. planners and Australian planners and others try to develop international or domestic programs that will serve the interests of their constituency, which are usually the wealthy and the privileged, there's no conspiracy, any more than there's a conspiracy when General Motors tries to sell cars.
I guess the challenge for most people when they first pick up one of your books is they're going to be confronted with an image of the West which doesn't correspond with the image that they probably have today, the commonly held view. I mean, they're going to be confronted with an image of the West as engineers of large-scale terrorism and being directly or indirectly responsible for terrible humanitarian crimes over the last, say, 50 years in particular.
Well, actually, we go back long before that.
Of course.
I started with the Second World War.
Yeah. But this obviously isn't the picture that most people in the West have of the countries that they live in, and it can be an extremely confronting exercise for them to come to terms with that change in perception. Do you have any suggestions to help people reconcile that perspective with the more commonly held view?
Yeah, very simple suggestion. Look into the facts. I mean, this isn't quantum physics. I mean, the evidence is pretty much is easily available if you want to look at it. Actually, one of the hardest things to do, whether in personal life or in thinking about international affairs, one of the hardest things to do is just to look into the mirror. I mean, we all know this in personal life. It's much more convenient to have illusions about yourself than to look into the mirror and see yourself honestly. Anyone who doesn't know that is just lying to themselves. We all know it. We create a image and picture of ourselves which fits our need to believe that what we're doing is basically benign and helpful and forthcoming and sympathetic, and sometimes it's true, but often it isn't. And when it isn't, we typically find ways of explaining it away. But if we're honest, we will look into the mirror and see what the truth is and do something about it. And the same is true when you look at international affairs. Now, there's a difference in this case. When it's a matter of just yourself, it's just a matter of how you deal with it. When you try to look honestly at your own society, its history, its actions, and so on, you are facing a massive deluge of propaganda and indoctrination that is trying to create a delusionary picture. So power systems are naturally, nothing conspiratorial, naturally they are going to dedicate enormous efforts to try to get the population to view the exercise of power and hierarchy and authority as if it's benign and full of benign intentions. I don't know an exception to that in history. I mean, if you read the pronouncements of even the worst monsters, Hitler, Stalin, Mao, Hirohito, it's all full of the most eloquent rhetoric about their noble intentions and how they're sacrificing themselves for the benefit of the people and so on and so forth. And yes, major institutions are developed to try to promulgate those ideas. And in fact, it's true that in the countries, most people believe them. So, for example, in Nazi Germany, until it began suffering serious military defeats. In Nazi Germany, Hitler was very popular, maybe the most popular leader in German history, and his conception of the nobility of their engagement in the world and domestically, that was widely accepted. Same in fascist Japan, same in Stalinist Russia. Yeah, that happens, and it also happens in more free societies. And furthermore, there's nothing novel about it. I mean, centuries ago, David Hume had an important work on political philosophy, what called The Foundations of the Theory of Government. His first principle of the foundation of government, he pointed out that power is actually, in any society, he said, power is in the hands of those who are governed. They don't know it, but power is actually in their hands. And therefore, to maintain authority, it is necessary to impose consent. It is necessary to compel the general population to consent to the authority of the masters. And he said that's true in every society, from the most free to the most despotic. And that's basically correct. Anyone with any degree of authority knows it, whether it's in a family or a school or a corporation or a government or, the World Bank. Yeah, that. You have to compel consent somehow. And to do that, we now have massive institutions, huge institutions, media, educational systems, huge public relations industries, which are, to a large extent, devoted to this. So if you want to discover the truth about your own society, its history, its workings, and so on, you do have to overcome barriers which are erected to prevent such understanding. But it's not very difficult. Again, it's not quantum physics.
So you obviously see a relationship then between the large commercial mainstream media organizations and these interests that hold power?
How can anyone doubt it? I mean, what are the mainstream media organizations? I mean, take, say, the United States, okay? I mean, the mainstream media organizations are major corporations, parts of even larger conglomerates. They, as economic institutions, they produce something, namely television or newspapers. But that's not what they're selling. What they're selling is audiences. They're selling audiences to advertisers, and the advertisers are their market. Well, the advertisers are just other major corporations, not in a local town where it may be the local drugstore, but in the national media, the major media, what you have is major corporations selling audiences to other major corporations. If you look at the elite media, the ones that more or less set the agenda for others, have the resources and so on, say the New York Times, the product that they're selling is privileged audiences. That's who reads the New York Times. So what you have is a major corporation selling privileged audiences to other major corporations. Well, if someone from Mars was looking at this, some rational scientist, what would he predict the nature of the news product would be? Mm-hmm. Something that suits the interests of the sellers, the buyers, and the product. And there's a very substantial tendency for that to be true. It's not 100% true. There's other factors. There's professional integrity. There's honest journalism. There's popular protest. Many other factors. The world is complicated. But the basic institutional structure is so transparent, you have to purposely blind yourself not to see it. And the general intellectual world works the same way. I mean, if you want to write an article, say, denouncing a dissident, say, denouncing me, let's say, it's trivial. You can produce any kind of lies you like, any sorts of hysteria. You don't need any evidence, and you'll get a major journal to publish it. On the other hand, if you tried to do that with picking as a target anyone who is in the, somewhere within the system of respectability and power, and pretty subordinate to power, you'd never get away with it for a minute. So those factors also enter. And there are plenty of very corrupt intellectuals who are willing to do that in every society. I mean, you know, we tend to, you look at the Soviet Union, the people we respect under the old Soviet Union are the dissidents. But they were a tiny minority. Mm-hmm. I mean, the mainstream intellectuals were the ones who were writing the denunciations and diatribes of the alleged crimes of the dissidents. And they were the ones who were respected. Sure.
Mm.
Very much like our society.
Which brings me to, I guess, the thing that I am most interested in chatting with you today is your personal motivation behind your political activism for the last 30 or 40 years. What is it that drives you?
Same as it did 60 years ago, 70 years ago, in fact. There are poor and suffering people in the world, and they need help, and we're in a position to give them help, because we are very privileged. We have a legacy of freedom and privilege which has been won by hard struggle, hasn't been given by from above. It's been won, but we have it, and we can use that to help people who are suffering seriously if we try. Furthermore, by now, as distinct from 70 years ago, there are major issues having to do with survival of the species. Two major issues, at least. One is the threat of nuclear war, which is very high, maybe as high as it's ever been, and that could mean total destruction. And the other is the threat of environmental catastrophe, which is coming and will come unless we do something to avert it. Well, those are two major issues, quite apart from the constant suffering, oppression, violence all over the world and in our own societies as well, which has many causes. But if we look carefully, we'll find that our own role is usually quite significant, sometimes decisive, and therefore we can do something about it.
There seems to be a general acceptance, I find, that, you know, post the 2003 US-led invasion of Iraq, there seems to be this very interesting general acceptance in people that I talk to, friends in the United States and certainly in Australia, that the motivation for the invasion was mostly around oil and a general show of power. And if I think back to the early 90s during the first, you know, Gulf conflict, that didn't seem to be a very popular or well-accepted opinion. Do you think it's changed? Do you think people are a lot more aware now than they were a decade ago?
Well, they're more aware now, but it was a popular opinion then. In fact, it wasn't concealed. I mean, did the United States... Iraq invaded Kuwait, and it was correct to force Iraq out of Kuwait. Probably could have been done without war, but could argue that. But one way or another, it was the right policy to force Iraq out of Kuwait. If those hadn't been huge oil producers, would anyone have cared? I mean, look, you're in Australia. When Indonesia invaded East Timor, did Australia take part in trying to force Indonesia out of East Timor? No. In fact, Australia was the first country to give de jure recognition to the conquest. Even though it was much worse, the invasion of Kuwait. I mean, maybe a quarter of the population. But nothing much was at stake for Australian power interests. So why stop? Kuwait was quite different. Kuwait's a major oil producer. The British economy, for example, has relied extensively on its quasi-colony in Kuwait. It's very closely tied to U.S. interests. In fact, if you go back to 1958, you know, when the first... 1958 is an important year. That was the first break in the Anglo-American condominium over Middle East energy production. U.S. and Britain pretty much ran it until 1958. In 1958, there was a military coup in Iraq, which overthrew the British-run client state and moved towards independence. in fact, towards independent development and even toward democracy. And the U.S. and Britain were terrified. We are free and open societies, so we have the documents. We know what they said to each other. We knew it in 1991, but the press kept it quiet. In 1958, the British foreign minister flew to Washington, had Selwyn Lloyd, had long discussions with John Foster Dulles. They tried to decide how to react to the fact that Iraq had broken free of Anglo-American control, and they concluded the following, which direct bearing on 1991. They said that the British colony of Kuwait should be given nominal independence, not real independence, but nominal independence, so let them run their own post office, and that might prevent the tide of nationalism from spreading to Kuwait. But if anything went wrong with this arrangement, from inside or outside, then Britain would, I'm now quoting, ruthlessly intervene to prevent it. And the United States took the same stand with regard to the bigger oil producers, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Emirates. If anything went wrong, the U.S. would ruthlessly intervene with force to prevent it. So any move towards independence or anything else. I mean, that was the planning in 1958. That's exactly what was implemented in 1991. I mean, any honest newspaper in the country or commentator would have been citing all of this. And that's the background for the war. And no one did. Actually, not no one. There are two or three people who did. I was one of them. But virtually none. Because you don't want people to understand what's happening. On the other hand, even with suppression of that, you know, pretty much anybody with their eyes open knew that a crucial issue in the first war was the fact that these are major oil producers. I mean, it didn't happen when Indonesia invaded Timor, when Israel invaded Lebanon, case after case.
So, I guess that, I know that you've got to go shortly, so let me ask you, people living in the West who are concerned by the sorts of measures that are being passed by governments in the United States, the UK and Australia over the last couple of years, what's your recommendation? What should they be doing? People who aren't, you know, experienced in political activism, what can they do to change the course of events as they're unfolding at the moment?
If there were any magic keys, somebody would have told us a long time ago. The ways to do it, everyone knows. They're hard. They're slow. Over time, they work. I mean, it requires efforts at patient education, which includes self-education, organization, try to develop and take part in popular organizations which are committed to these efforts, and then undertaking activism of the kind that happens to be appropriate to circumstances, and there's no formulas for that. I mean, that's how progress is made. That's why we got rid of slavery, and that's why we have women's rights, some degree of civil rights. And that's why opposition to aggression has grown so enormously over the years. That's why we have freedom of speech. I mean, every one of the benefits that we enjoy in our current legacy was achieved this way, not by going to a demonstration and it didn't work, so I'm going home and quitting, but by working at it day after day. If in an electoral system, there's no use coming along every couple of years and saying, vote for me. I mean, you want a political alternative, you got to work on it every day. Locally, regionally, setting up the basis for it, getting people engaged and involved in it. Then maybe you'll have something to offer when a major election comes along. And the same with everything else. And the same with the trade agreements. I mean, for example, Australia just agreed to a outrageous trade agreement with the United States, which may end up seriously harming the quite efficient Australian health system. Australia didn't have to agree to that. If there was enough public protest, they wouldn't have. And so it goes for every other issue.
Rosa Parks recently passed away almost exactly 50 years after she refused to give a seat on an Alabama bus to a white man. I guess, you know, in her lifetime she saw a lot of change, so progress is possible.
Yeah, it is. And remember that Rosa Parks was a marvelous and important person, but that story is falsified. Rosa Parks didn't come out of nowhere. She came out of an organized community
ACP.
That was planning actions like that and had a support system set up. Mm-hmm. And she was the person who did it.
Mm.
As history is written, it's made to be personalized, as if some great person suddenly did everything. That's an effort to disempower people, to make them fail to understand what's involved. What's involved is just what I described before, as it was in the Rosa Parks case.
Mm-hmm.
Intensive educational programs, substantial organization, and then this action, which was courageous and appropriate and made a difference.
Professor Chomsky, I'll let you go. I know you've got a very busy schedule today. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for your work over the last 40, 50 years. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Have a great day.
Yep.
Cheers.
Bye.
Hey. Yeah, that's me. Yeah, from the beginning. That's right. I'm back at the end. I waited around for the entire podcast just to tell you that it was brought to you by Motorola. Yeah, dude. I gotta get some nachos. I am so hungry. Are there any near your house?
The Podcast Network. Real power can't be given.
It must be taken.